This podcast is brought to you by AJ Bell and Shares Magazine. Shares Magazine is published by AJ Bell Media, part of AJ Bell.
Hi there, my name is Dan Coatsworth. Welcome to our second podcast dedicated to investment trusts. Now, for those who didn't catch the last edition, we're now running a bonus podcast once a month alongside the normal weekly AJ Bell Money and Market Show. So in this special investment trust podcast, we will discuss hot topics with a range of investment experts and fund managers. We'll have some educational content to get listeners up to speed if they're not familiar with investment trusts. We'll also debate some of the most popular investment trusts on the market. So joining me on this show is Laith Khalaf.
Yeah, hi there, Dan. We're also going to be delving into one of the big conundrums for investors, which is whether to use the services of active fund managers, putting money into an actively managed investment vehicle, or simply taking the route of investing in a low-cost tracker fund that just follows the market. Now, with so many fund managers failing to outperform, for some people, it's an easy choice to make. And that does present a problem for active managers in the long term. Now, we often have fund managers on this show talking about their portfolios and the markets, but we actually thought it would be a good idea to get one on the show specifically to debate this topic.
Yeah, that's right. So later on, we'll hear from Stuart Gray from Alliance Trust to get his thoughts on this subject.
And Ian Conway and Steve Fraser from Shares Magazine will also be here to debate the merits of Finsbury Growth and Income, a prime example of an investment trust that has now underperformed for 3 years in a row.
Shares Magazine's Tom Seaver is going to join us to talk about an investment trust that's literally shooting for the moon as it hopes to make money from investing in space. So far, the results have been a bit patchy for shareholders.
Okay, first up, we're going to look at the growing trend for mergers in the investment trust space. So joining us to discuss why so many trusts are looking to cozy up to one another and what it means for investors is James Carthew, Head of Investment Company Research at Quoted Data.
So James, we've definitely seen a trend over the past year for investment trusts to merge. I'm just wondering if I could get your thoughts about why is this happening? And is it a sign that something hasn't gone right if a trust decides to merge?
You can be very deeply cynical about this. For one thing, what we haven't seen in the sector is an awful lot of share issuance recently. And so it may be that the advisors are looking around for other ways to make money. And the fees that you get for advising on a merger are quite chunky, as you're seeing some of these things. So that might be part of the reason. But I think generally because we've had this big kind of spate of discount widening across the sector, the boards are being more proactive and they are looking around and thinking, are there alternatives to what we're doing? Would we be more attractive if we were bigger? Would we be more attractive if we were doing something else slightly? And so they are exploring those things and they are having conversations, and this seems to be leading this kind of spate of mergers. And it's interesting to see what's coming out, you know, coming out of the woodwork. There's things that I just wouldn't have imagined happening that have got away. So it's interesting. And I think generally to be encouraged, not every merger makes complete sense to me. That doesn't necessarily mean it has to. It's the fact is whether the shareholders want to happen or not. But I think generally it's a good thing. So in part, it's a response to the big kind of wealth manager investors saying, we want bigger, more liquid investment trusts. So we want things that are easier to deal in. And if that's going to be the case, they need to be. They used to say 100 million, then they said 200 million, then they said 400 million. And now they're sort of starting to talk about £1 billion funds is the sort of thing that they want to invest in. But you can't run the whole industry just for their benefit. It's also got to be for the benefit of the individual shareholders too. And there are funds that are too small. And definitely anything below probably 20, 25 million is definitely too small. But the mergers actually seem to be happening in slightly bigger funds. And I think that is because of this fee problem, that you've got a certain level of costs involved that just don't make sense for something that's 25 million quid market cap. So, there's a whole lot of stuff going on here. There's lots of different influences, but generally it's a good thing and should be encouraged.
I know last year we saw the asset managers Aberdeen and Janice Henderson. They both seem to be doing like a cleaning up process. They seem to have so many tiny little trusts, and they made that decision to perhaps merge some of those together. More recently, we saw Tritax Big Box say it would like to merge with UK Commercial Property REIT. Now, Tritax obviously a much bigger beast. That one was quite surprising to me, because I thought Tritax is obviously, it's well known for owning these gigantic warehouses that help to fill all the goods that you need for online shopping. Whilst there's sort of been a suggestion that industry might have gone through a bit of a bubble phase and valuations got a bit of ahead of themselves, why does Tritax need to merge with someone else? I thought it was doing all right on its own.
That is a good question. And it's not an obvious fit either, because obviously, as you say, the Tritax is in these big boxes, these huge sheds that you see along the motorways. UK Commercial Property has got a mixed portfolio. So about half is industrial, but it's got all sorts of other bits and pieces in there too. And you wouldn't have thought that would have been a natural thing to put together. There was a proposal not that long ago, actually, that Picton Property wanted to buy UK Commercial Property. And the board kind of pushed back on that and said no. The value that didn't make sense to them. And it's interesting, though, in this particular idea, with the Tritax UK Commercial Property deal, that the chairman of UK Commercial Property said no. He doesn't think it's a great idea. But that's by the by. It does feel a bit like size for size sake with this one. Like you say, Tritax is already a nice big liquid fund. Part of the rationale is that they create this thing which could be the third or fourth biggest real estate investment trust in the sector. It's hard to gain them at the to work out what the motivation is behind some of these boards and what they're trying to do, or whether it's the managers pushing this. There is Tritax, though, is and there's a sort of Aberdeen link there, so that it is sort of keeping within family still, which I suppose it's maybe part of their particular box.
So I guess if you're an investor in an investment trust and you see one of your holdings announce a merger with someone else, is it good news or bad news? Obviously, one of the things that we do see is potentially see lower fees, which is definitely good news. Mm-hmm. But is there, what other things should people think about if this is happening to something in their portfolio?
Sometimes you're being offered something that is very different to what you invested in. And actually, that's part of the thing with this UK Commercial Property thing, and maybe why the chairman's dissenting from it, is that if you invested because it was a nicely balanced property fund, and you're going to end up with something that's very, very focused on industrial logistics stuff, was that really what you wanted to buy in the first place? There's a more obvious example with a proposal to merge JP Morgan Multi-Asset Growth and Income with JP Morgan Global Growth and Income. So Multi-Asset Growth and Income had a very clear objective from the outset with it was going to give you a low volatility of returns and a high income. And you're going to get something which is a slightly lower income and much more volatile. So a cash exit opportunity with that one. So is that really what you wanted? And I suppose that's a big consideration when these things come along. Are you going to end up with shares that you want? And if you don't want it, are you being offered the chance to get out of your position close to asset value? So can you get cash close to asset value? And that should be a prerequisite for most of these deals. If you don't like it, this should be an opportunity to get out.
So some of these trusts that are merging now, it's not the first time they've done it, because JP Morgan Global Growth and Income merged with the Scottish Investment Trust. That seemingly has come out, certainly shareholders should be happy on that one. They've done very well since that merger. But I'm right in saying that that's it's also done another merger along the way. I don't know if you could.
There's been a few of these things. They also took out JP Morgan Elect, which is one of these interesting funds where you could choose to be invested in one type of investment pool, or you could switch into another one, and there'd be no capital gains incurred in doing that. And those sorts of funds have been disappearing. And the latest one of those that's about to go now, Invesco Perpetual Select, has got four different pools, and they're going to merge everything into their global equity income fund. And actually, when they've done that, it's going to be a direct competitor to the JP Morgan one. They've obviously seen the opportunity here and the fact that people seem to like this kind of format, and they're going to have something else which gives you 4% income every year on the NAV, some of it manufactured capital, so it can invest in lower yielding things and try and go for high growth stuff. Interesting to see where that all gets away and people like it. But there's been some dissent there too. So Dress has come out and said that he really doesn't like the whole idea of giving up his investment in a cheap UK equity fund, which is part of the pool, that to go into more expensive global growth stocks. You don't always get what you want with these things.
So that was James Carthew from Quoted Data. Laith, while we're on the subject of mergers, I know that you've been looking at the personal finance implications of what happens if an investor sees one of their investment trust holdings merge with one another, or actually what happens if they've been taken over or even wound up. So I think it'd be really useful if you could explain what investors need to think about if any of these situations happen.
Sure. Well, I think generally speaking, there are two big things that you need to think about. The first is the kind of investment situation, and the second is the tax implications. So if your trust winds up, what you're going to find yourself being handed is some cash. So obviously, you're going to need to choose a new home for that money. Now, the obvious answer is to look for a similar trust. So if you have a UK equity trust, you might recycle it into a UK equity trust again. There's nothing wrong with that. But before you do that, I think it's just worth looking at your overall portfolio, just considering whether a trust investing in that particular area still fits the bill, because really a cash takeover is actually a good opportunity to consider your portfolio. You've got essentially a blank sheet of paper with that money. You know, maybe you don't need to change where you're putting it, but it's worth thinking about it before you just buy a similar trust as a sort of knee-jerk reaction. If your investment trust merges, then you're going to be handed shares in a new investment trust. Now, that new investment trust may well operate a similar investment strategy to the one you used to hold. It may even have the same manager, but it might not. So you do need to kind of have a look at the information that's sent to you about that new trust. Make sure you're happy with it, with the investment process, with the manager, particularly if they have changed. If your trust merges, then you need to reassess that new investment proposition with a pretty critical eye. And again, it's probably a good idea to think about it as if you're starting with a blank sheet of paper. Would you want to be invested in that if you just had, you know, some money to spare and were looking to allocate it? So that's kind of investment side. You know, probably the one thing that people don't think about as much is perhaps the tax side of things. So, you know, mergers, closures, they can potentially open you up to tax, in particular capital gains tax. So a little bit of a disclaimer here so that I don't end up in jail is it's important to note that tax implications are determined by your personal circumstances. If you're in any doubt, seek professional advice. But generally speaking, if you hold a trust outside of a SIP or ISA, it winds up and returns cash to you, then you're potentially liable to capital gains tax if you've made a gain, which hopefully you will have done. This year you have a CGT allowance of £6,000. That's fallen to £3,000 from 6th of April. Anything above that, you're potentially liable to CGT. If the two trusts merge and you receive shares in a new trust, then normally actually there's not a capital gains tax liability. You basically just carry the cost of your original investment cost to your new investment and then have to make that calculation when you sell the new trust. You might get a combination of cash and shares as part of the merger, so there might be some capital gains tax liability on the cash element. And of course, if you decide to sell out of a trust because it's winding up or merging before that actually happens, that counts as a liquidation. Any gains potentially taxable. So if you want to shelter yourself from those taxes, of course, SIPs and ISAs are pretty useful ways to do that. Whether your investment trust or winding up or not, to be perfectly honest, you can also do a BED and SIP or a BED and ISA. with any trusts that you don't already hold within those tax shelters. We actually covered those in a recent podcast on the 16th of February. So I won't go into too much detail on that here. You can go back and listen to that if you're interested. And another thing to consider if you're facing a large tax bill because a trust is winding up, it's a bit cheeky this one, but you might consider transferring some of your holdings to a spouse or a civil partner beforehand. That move itself doesn't incur a tax charge, but you can then make use of two capital gains tax allowances. There may also be a benefit if one of you is a lower earner, because higher rate taxpayers get charged a higher rate of CGT as well. So I think, Dan, those are the general considerations for wind-up mergers. So broadly speaking, how it affects your investment portfolio and what are the tax implications?
Well, thanks, Leith. That was really useful. So, I mean, earlier on, I promised that we'd chat about investing in space. So it's time to bring on Tom Sieber. Now, Tom, good to see you.
Good to see you too, Dan.
Last show that we did about investment trusts, we had Emma Bird from Winterflood. We were talking about the concept of investment trusts trading on discounts, so essentially trading below the value of their assets. And one of the things we were talking about is how investors quite like to look for trusts where that discount could narrow. We see a slight re-rating in their sort of share price as it happens. So one really good example of this happening in recent months is Seraphim. So Tom, I think let's start the conversation by explaining what on earth is Seraphim trying to do? Sure. And then perhaps why was it on such a big discount in the first place, and perhaps what sort of triggered that discount to narrow?
Absolutely. So Seraphim is basically the only way that UK investors can invest in early stage space technology companies. It launched in, and you can't really employ the cliche that it failed to launch. It did launch in July 2021 and it got off to a reasonably good start, raised about £150 million to invest in this sector. It did well, and basically until there was a pivot in terms of interest rates and rates started going up, and as per the sort of previous discussions that you've had on the podcast, that led to an increase in discount rates, and that's really hurt investment trusts across the board. What probably made it worse for Seraphim is that it has a large number of private holdings, and we've seen that with larger investment trusts like Scottish Mortgage, that in the current environment, people don't like privately held investments as much, and there's some skepticism about the actual valuation of those assets because they don't trade day to day on a market, so you can't see the valuation, as it were. So those factors, plus I guess space is seen as a fairly sort of speculative area, they've all conspired to drive the discount to quite an extreme level at Seraphim at one point. Subsequent to that, there has been a recovery, as you point out, so sort of since perhaps November last year, and that's kind of in line with the trends you're seeing in the wider market. But it's still at a near 50% discount to net asset value. So it's still at quite a elevated discount, you would say.
I think this is one of the trusts where there was a lot of excitement when it first joined the market. Yeah. I think people like the idea of like, it's a, you know, a real unique way of investing, and you're quite exciting. And typically the narrative is sort of been a bit more exciting than the actual returns that this trust has delivered. I think a lot of investors will be sort of slightly frustrated by it. I guess it's, you know, they might be relieved that there's been this little uptick in the share price recently, but I guess who knows where it will go next?
It's hard to judge. I mean, I guess a key thing that might help, and that's, you know, this applies almost to Scottish Mortgage's privately held assets as well, is if you start to see some exits at valuations that are close to what they're being kind of marked up at by the trust itself. So that could be listing on a stock market, obviously, or it could be an acquisition. There haven't been any exits, or certainly none of note from the Seraphim space portfolio. So you haven't had that opportunity to sort of crystallize the value, and therefore the market sort of then perhaps gives a bit more credibility to the valuations of the other privately held assets. So that's part of the problem. And I guess, you know, as you were saying, there was a lot of excitement about this area, but you've had some high profile disappointments, particularly Virgin Orbit. People might remember last year it was attempting to be the sort of first UK company to put a satellite into space, and you know, it didn't work out, safe to say. So that has affected sentiment more generally towards space and sort of the commercial space sector. You know, this is still a very nascent, very early stage sector, and I guess it means that, you know, there's a healthy dose of skepticism around just how much money can be made here and what are the right companies to be invested in.
Well, thanks, Tom. That's really useful.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. Very well done for avoiding lots of space-based puns as well. Very impressive. I don't think I could have shown the same restraint. And now it's time to bring on our next guest. Stuart Gray is one of the co-portfolio managers on Alliance Trust, one of the most popular investment trusts among the UK public. He plays a key role in trying to ensure that investors who pay an annual management charge for Alliance Trust are getting their money's worth. Now, active managers are paid to outperform, but they don't always do it. Now, Dan recently caught up with Stuart to talk about what investors might want to do if their active fund isn't performing as expected. And Stuart has some really interesting things to say, so let's hear from him now.
So, Stuart, investors use actively managed funds and trusts in the hope of beating the market. Now, we're seeing a number of popular trusts and funds fail to beat the market for multiple years in a row. And I think this is sort of prompting investors to question their commitment to these types of products. And instead, they're looking at tracker funds. I just wanted to get, what's your sort of your take on this? What's your view about this situation? Do you think actually investors should be a bit more patient with actively managed trusts and funds if they're underperforming?
Yeah, so the short answer is I think investors do need to be more patient with active funds in general. But that's perhaps not very realistic as an expectation, to be honest, because we're all human and performance and short-term performance affects what we think of things. So I think there's probably two key points about this situation, if you like, of underperforming active funds and the rise of passive. First of all, active management is frankly very hard to do. Most studies show that most active products underperform net of fees over the very long term, maybe as much as 80% of funds underperform. So that's quite a big number. And it's not surprising, therefore, that a lot of people will choose a passive option. It's simple, it's cheap. But the problem with this, of course, is that you're giving up a huge opportunity in active investing, which is if you can harness active returns, it can be really, really powerful for your portfolio. Let's just take a quick example. I mean, let's just say, make up some numbers here. Let's just say equities over the long term deliver, say, 4% per annum ahead of inflation over the long term. If you can add 1% or 2% of active return on top, you know, you've just increased your return by 25 to 50%. And the, you know, the eighth wonder of the world, the power of compounding that always blows people's minds, is that if you add that up over decades or a generation, then it can lead to huge impact on your retirement fund, if you like. So active management, really hard to do, but if you can do it well, it can be incredibly powerful. And I think, the second point I was going to make here just quickly is that you mentioned that a number of funds are underperforming now. And I think this is really because if you look at today's market, you know, the largest stocks in the market have been some of the best performing stocks over the last 5 or maybe even 10 years. And that means that the passive portfolio has been a very well, you know, very good performing portfolio. So people are now looking at saying, well, it's cheap, it's easy, and it's performed really well. So, of course, why wouldn't you go passive? But I think the observation there is simply that the largest stocks in the universe being the best performing stocks in the universe doesn't happen very often and doesn't generally persist. So there's all sorts of risks to that thinking, if you like.
Lots of people say that in sort of choppy market conditions, actually, you know, this is where a fund manager can show their skills, do very well. But I'm just trying to sort of thinking back over the last, say, 3-4 years, it's been a very unusual situation. We've had, you know, inflation and rapid rise in interest rates. But actually, that's the period where lots of these sort of well-known fund managers haven't done that well, isn't it? And it's, you know, I'm just wondering, is there an environment which, if you look back over history, that actually the periods when you want to be holding actively managed funds is, you know, can you define that period when you should be having them?
So I think it's always, you know, everyone's always looking for the holy grail of the answer to what should I own at this point in time. And if we could always point out that now is the right time to own active and now is the right time to own passive, that would be great. But of course, it's never always that easy. I think, you know, one of the big challenges is that there's been so much sort of external impact on the markets recently. And, you know, this starts to sound like an excuse very quickly when active managers talk about this. But, you know, the impact of COVID, the impact of central bank stimulus and the central bank's control of the interest rate environment, the impact of wars, inflation, you know, these are all things that active managers have had to contend with. And it's made it, I would say, unusual in terms of the market environment versus history. So you're right. You know, in a time when you'd expect active managers to be, you know, providing you some protection against some of these things, actually, that hasn't always been the case. And I think it's, you know, it's to do with a lot of factors, partly because of that market environment and partly because of so much external factors being involved.
So Alliance Trust is a popular investment trust with retail investors. It invests in global equities. It's perhaps a perfect example of something where someone has chosen to use the services of an active, actively managed product rather than just tracking the market. And they're hoping for this outperformance. So I had a quick look at some of the performance stats. Over the last 5 years until 16th of February this year, Alliance Trust has delivered 75% total return. So if you compare that to the MSCI All Country World Index, which is like a benchmark of global equities, that returns 68%. So you've got your outperformance there. If you look over 3 years, Alliance Trust has done 38 versus 27% from the MSCI index. So yeah, definitely on that basis, you're outperforming. But there have been plenty of shorter periods in that time frame when you've underperformed. So what do you do when you get a shareholder who's saying, hang on a minute, I'm paying you a little fee to beat the market, but you're not doing it consistently? What can you tell someone in response to that sort of remark?
Yeah, absolutely. So as you rightly say, there's of course periods where we underperform. No product in the world can just outperform all the time forever. It's just not possible. But as you say, you know, we have outperformed over those longer periods, and that's what the strategy is designed to do. So we can maybe talk about this in a bit more detail. But you know, we'll always have some shareholders coming to us at times saying, you know, why has the performance been behind the benchmark over this period, etc. And again, it gets back to this normal human behavior that people don't like underperformance. You know, the expectation is that an underperforming product must mean that it's not a good enough product and you must do something about it. So these are all the questions which creep into people's minds, and we'll always have those questions. So really our job is just to, you know, remind people of, you know, the philosophy, the process that the trust is trying to deploy to deliver the objective, which is to deliver value over the long term, and really just put the performance in context so that people can understand, is what's happening a reasonable thing to have happened given how the trust operates, or is something going wrong? Is something not being executed in the way that it should be doing, which will tell us that there's a problem here and that we should actually do something? So as long as you can reassure people that actually everything that's happening, it is sort of within the bounds of what should be happening, then hopefully people have been willing to stay a longer course and hopefully get the rewards, as you say, of longer term outperformance.
I think if we go back 5-10 years ago, there was a bit of a sort of cult of the star fund manager, names like Neil Woodford, but that sort of cult seems to have sort of faded away in recent years. And I wonder, perhaps, is it because of Neil Woodford's funds have effectively collapsed and people got burnt there? Do you think that might be a key reason why tracker funds and sort of ETFs are now becoming more popular, alongside the general underperformance from lots of sort of well-known investment products in recent years?
Yeah, it's an interesting point because I think undoubtedly it will have contributed. And there's probably a few different things at play here. But if you think about what we were saying earlier, that active management is hard to do and picking outperforming funds is not easy. So how do people do it? a lot of people are doing this in their spare time, in their evenings and weekends, and there's not a huge amount of information for people to go on. So having a star fund manager is helpful in the sense that it's sort of a widely accepted view that this is a skilled manager who can generally outperform. So it makes that process of how do I pick a fund easier, so people are willing to do it. But of course, you know, not even Warren Buffett outperforms all the time. And you know, eventually you go through tough periods, and that's when you tend to have problems. And Woodford is a slightly special case. There's some other issues there at play, which perhaps we won't get into now. But in general, you can look across the market, and there's been a number of star fund managers over the years who have hit rocky patches. And of course, it shakes people's confidence. But I think it gets back to this idea that, you know, for many investors, picking funds is quite hard to do. And having sort of the long-term patience and being able to manage that portfolio is quite difficult. So, yeah, I think undoubtedly when it doesn't work, people are more inclined to go passive. So that's definitely part of it.
That was Stuart Gray from Alliance Trust. Now, we've got time for just one more segment on our special podcast about investment trusts. Nick Train is one of the best-known fund managers in the UK. He helps to run the Finsbury Growth and Income Trust as a widely held investment trust among retail investors. It had done well for a very long time, up until the past 3 years when it's lagged the market. And to debate what's going on, let's bring on Ian Conway and Steve Fraser from Shares Magazine.
I think you can say Finsbury Growth and Income, and in fact, all the funds run by Lindsay Train, have been a byword for quality at a reasonable price. They haven't shot the lights out over the years, but it's certainly been dependable. So the two guys set up in 2000, and they've run Finsbury Growth and Income since then. Over 24 years, it's posted a 9% compound annual return, which is good. It's certainly better than the FTSE All Share, which has posted just over 5% over that time. But you could say the FTSE All Share, I mean, it is a UK fund, and they do specify it's a UK fund. But, you know, if you compared it with the MSCI All World, for example, you know, it wouldn't look quite so great. But it's done a pretty good job. However, last 3 years, it's underperformed the market. And I think there's a couple of reasons for that. We were discussing before this about Berkshire and about the level of concentration. And you mentioned that they kind of like the dynamic duo. They're a bit Buffett-like. There is even a quote on the Finsbury Growth and Income website talking about buying high quality and never selling. It's not as concentrated as Berkshire. We were chatting about Apple being half the quoted portfolio. They're very high conviction, though. They are very high conviction.
I mean, it is interesting that they choose to pursue, like so many retail investors, choose to follow the sage of Omaha, Warren Buffett. And there's nothing wrong with trying to replicate such a doyen of the investment market. But they do seem to be making questionable calls, it seems, in some of their stock selections and so on.
Yeah, they last year. So if you take last year, because they're so concentrated, 85% of the portfolios in the top 10 stocks. Last year, the shares went up 3.9%. The All Share did nearly double that. It did double that, 7.9%. The year before that, the trust lost 6% when the index was flat. And going back another year, they were up 13%. The index was up 18%. Now, you know, investors, I think the thing is, investors don't question where the returns come from when times are good.
Yeah.
And all the way up until 2020, 2021, returns were great. The last three years, they have struggled. And he says, last year in particular, he reckons it was down to not owning mining and energy stocks. Now, actually,
that's Nick Train. That's what Nick Train's saying.
That's Nick Train. Yeah, that's Nick Train's. That's what he put in his December fund commentary. And, you know, if you're a quality investor, I completely get you don't own energy and mining stocks because they don't set the price. The market sets the price. And so they tend to be fairly low return. But he also admits his stock picking hasn't been up to scratch. And he says, I've invested in some companies where my confidence in their earnings power and undervaluation has been misplaced, at least to date. And I think there's another thing to discuss there with the to date. But say, if you look at the portfolio last year, four of the top 10 stocks underperformed the market, and they represented 30% by weight of that portfolio. And that's at the end of 2023. So they would have started 2023 with a higher weighting.
And of course, the UK market has been it's been struggling for a number of years now as well. So, I mean, that's not going to be helpful. But presumably they do invest in, I mean, I was under the impression that they do have some overseas stocks. It's largely UK focused, but they do own shares in some US companies, for example, don't they?
They do, Steve. Yep, they own Mondelez. And in Europe, they are in the top 10. They also own Heineken.
Right.
But it's just curious. As I say, I think going back to the ones that underperformed last year and his admission that he sticks with losers maybe too long.
Right.
You know, Diageo lost 22% last year. Burberry lost 30% last year. This is actually, we've seen this in other Lindsay Trained funds. It's not just Finsbury Growth and Income. They do tend to stick with losers for quite a long time. And the other thing is, they do tend to go for the second players in a sector.
Right.
Given that they can own European stocks, and we're chatting about this, given they can own European stocks, why Burberry, why not LVMH or Hermès?
Right.
You know, which have better margins, they grow faster.
Yeah.
And you know, why Diageo? I don't buy that Diageo is a luxury stock. Real luxury stocks control the supply and the distribution.
And it's that pricing power, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. And I think there's a value angle to this. I think they don't like to pay up for market leaders. But actually, I'm not sure I agree with that strategy.
Yeah.
And there are quite a few stocks in here. There's some great stocks in the portfolio, don't get me wrong. But there are a few too many that would be your second choice in a sector rather than your first choice in a sector.
Yeah.
There's one of the overriding things, and they keep saying about the portfolio, is that they love data. They love companies that process data. So maybe that's kind of informing these decisions.
Sure.
But that feeds into another thing for me, which is the makeup of the portfolio. It's okay being concentrated, but it feels to me like it's concentrated for the sake of being concentrated. And, you know, they don't own energy and mining stocks. Fine, I get that. But the sectors that they like and the stocks that they buy, so a lot of media in there, things like RELX, Experian.
Right.
There's
so again, LSE they both play to the data discussion, the point you
absolutely
just made.
Yeah. There's LSE Group, which is now a data story,
sure,
but wasn't presumably when they bought it. They've got Sage, and that's their one concession to technology. Now, I read somewhere, and somebody will probably pick me up on this and say, oh, no, that's not right. But I did read somewhere that Nick Train said he doesn't get technology, so he's only got the one stock. But again, to me, if you don't get technology, hire someone who does. Because if you think of the opportunities that they've missed by owning Sage. Now, Sage was actually the best performer last year. It was up 57%. So it's come good. Done this year, 0.5% in January.
It's
had a nice move, but if you don't get tech, as I say, why don't you just employ somebody that does? And that's kind of, I look at the makeup of the portfolio, and it seems to me it's been constructed from a top down point of view rather than a bottom up point of view.
That's an interesting point.
Well, I go back to the
That's unusual for an active fund manager to have that view. If that is how the stocks are selected, that's unusual for active managers.
It's just my impression, Steve. That's the thing. It's you know, they say on the website they need the freedom to invest in line with their investment principles, as if it was their own money. They're going to maximise returns over the longer term. But that's a bit woolly.
Yes.
And it's not, you know, there isn't, as with Fundsmith, let's say, there's a shareholder's handbook. you understand the process. We've discussed lots of times.
Yes.
We understand the process. He likes ROCE, he likes high gross margins, high free cash flow yields versus the market, and so on.
Yeah, of course, we're
you
talking about
those...
ROCE, you're talking about return on capital employed.
Yeah, sorry, yes, return on capital employed. And all those things go into the process. You can understand the process. Whether you agree with the picks
sure.
is another matter. But when you look at the portfolio at Finsbury Growth and Income, it's quite hard to work out sometimes why they own the stocks that they own.
Yeah,
and it does
yeah.
seem to me as though there's a bias towards certain parts of the market. I mean, it has a very high weighting in consumer. But again, discuss. You know, do you want Burberry or do you want LVMH or even something like Ferrari, which has been an amazing stock in, you know,
yeah,
it's
absolutely.
In that space as well. There's Diageo, which, as I say, it's a 5% grower. It's not great. Unilever, again, mid single digits grower.
Sure.
Even some of the stocks that you would think would be fast growers, like Experian, mid-single digits,
yeah,
over the very long term.
Right.
So it's just the way the portfolio is put together. And when you look at 2024, and just watching Nick Train's presentation, he's saying that the fact that it's concentrated in areas that have done well in the past ensures, or he would hope ensures, that it does well in 2024. That's not giving me a great deal of confidence.
So thanks very much to Ian and Steve for chatting about Finsbury Growth and Income. Now, if there's a particular trust you'd like us to debate on the podcast, we'd love to hear your suggestions. Email podcast@ajbell.co.uk.
That's all we've got time for this week. We'd love to know what you thought of this bonus podcast on investment trusts. You can use that same email address to get in touch with us. We'd also be very grateful if you could also leave a review of the podcast on your streaming platform of choice. We'll be back in a few days' time with the usual Money and Markets podcast. Until then, thanks for listening.
Before you go, please remember this podcast is for educational purposes, and the views expressed don't necessarily reflect those of AJ Bell or Shares Magazine. The podcast isn't telling you if a certain investment is suitable or not. Don't forget that the value of investments can change and you can lose money as well as make it. It's also important to remember that how you're taxed will depend on your individual circumstances, and rules can change. The way an investment performed in the past may not be the same as how it behaves in the future. If you want help, go see a qualified financial advisor.